Made from what? Hospital sheets. And who's going to spend money on a wedding dress if food gets really scarce like they're saying it will? Or if bombs are dropping every night? Don't they teach you current events in school? School's not in session, and war makes brides as easily as it makes widows. You told me that yourself. But not as plentifully. I've had no customers yesterday or today, except for the young woman who bought that veil. Give your cousin the sketches, Mrs. Crofton, please. I promise I will come back as soon as I can, war or no war. She exhaled heavily. All right. And you'll let me know when he returns to London? Mrs. Crofton nodded. Send me your address when you're situated. They stood there for a moment looking at each other. I don't have any work for you today, Emmeline, Mrs. Crofton finally said. You can teach me how to line a bodice. She lifted up the corners of her mouth in a half-smile. I almost envy you, getting out of here like you are, away from all this. You don't know how good you have it. I'll trade places with you. Mrs. Crofton laughed gently. If you were my daughter, Emmeline, I would do the same as your mum. I'd send you away to safety, too. I had a daughter once, you know. Emmy didn't. Mrs. Crofton stared at the wall behind her, as if it were a window to the past. She died of a fever when she was 6. I'm so sorry, Mrs. Crofton. Her employer hovered there, on the edge between the present and past, and then she turned toward the wall and plugged in the electric tea kettle that sat on a little table by the door to the loo. Emmy waited to hear more about the daughter who had died, but Mrs. Crofton only said she was terribly sorry that she'd run out of sugar, and there wasn't any more at the grocery. Chapter 8. The day Emmy and Julia left London, the June sun spilled cheerfully out of the sky, dousing everyone with extravagant and unnecessary warmth. A somber fog would have suited Emmy better, or a pelting downpour. She didn't want the heavens affirming this plan as she and her sister trudged to Julia's school, suitcases in hand, nor as they waited in a sunny sea of emotional mothers, wide-eyed tots, and uniformed officials pretending that what they were doing was perfectly normal. From the school, the sisters would continue by bus, then by train, and lastly by motor car or delivery truck or gypsy cart, who really knew, to wherever it was they were to call home. Emmy's solitary consolation as she packed her satchel was that she had discovered the key to Primrose's back door, which she had forgotten to return to Mrs. Crofton when they said their goodbyes. It was like an omen that she would have to come back to London to return it to Mrs. Crofton. She slipped the key into her skirt pocket, letting her fingers linger over its shape, before she withdrew her hand. They arrived at the school 15 minutes after the time Mum was told to have them there, but their tardiness didn't seem to matter. The queues of parents waiting to register their children were long and curly-queued, and the general feeling, despite the happy sun, was one of quiet desperation. The animated chatter of nervous adolescents was only slightly louder than the agitated voices of parents who wanted more information than anyone in charge was prepared to give them. The billeting officials, to whom they had appealed, sat behind long tables and scarcely looked up from their piles of paper, so intent were they on making sure they didn't lose someone's child into the abyss of this second evacuation scheme. The youngest children clung to their mother's hands. Some of them knew from the first evacuation what trauma was about to befall them, and they buried their heads in their mother's skirts. The oldest evacuees, teenagers like Emmy, gazed about in disbelief, looking for all the world like they wanted to disappear into a separate dimension, while the adults played war with one another. Emmy didn't see anyone she knew, probably because they were meeting at Julia's school, not hers. Mum returned from waiting in one of those snaking queues, with stringed cardboard tags for Emmy and Julia, and luggage labels that bore their names, ages, Mum's name, and their London address. Julia's tag went promptly around her neck. I'm not wearing this, Emmy said, handing the name tag back to Mum. You have to, Mum said, ignoring her daughter's outstretched hand. She bent down to attach the luggage labels to the suitcases at their feet. Emmy looped the name tag around the handle of the gas mask box that all the children were made to carry. Mum stood up, saw that Emmy didn't have the string around her neck, and huffed. Emmy, please, just do it. I'm not five, Mum. Then don't act like you are. Mum yanked the tag off the handle of Emmy's gas mask box and slipped it over her head. What does this say? Julia peered at the small typewritten words below her name and Mum's on the tag. Morton and Marsh, Mum said, straightening Julia's barrette. That's where your train is headed. What's a marsh again? Julia furrowed her brow. It's an oozing swamp, Emmy said under her breath. Morton and Marsh is a nice town in Gloucestershire, Mum said to Julia, after a quick frown Emmy's way. It's a sweet little place, the registrar told me, in the Cotswolds. There are others from your school going to the same place, Julia, so you'll already know people. And my school? Are there others from my school? Emmy asked, her voice terse with cynicism. Mum faced her. There are plenty of people your age being evacuated, Emmy. Plenty. Look around. Stop making this so difficult. Emmy wasn't making anything difficult. Everyone else was making things difficult. This was not her war. Nothing about what was happening was her doing, or had anything to do with her. A uniformed official speaking through a public address system called for those headed west to Gloucestershire and Oxfordshire. It was time to board the bus that would take them to the train station. Emmy lifted her suitcase, and Mum laid hold of her arm. Don't let them separate you, she said, softly but urgently. If anyone tries, you give them hell. Promise? Emmy's suitcase, the gas mask, and the bride's box in her arms suddenly seemed weightless compared to the burden of being forced to release all the good fortune that so recently had come her way. It was as if her dreams were spiraling out of reach, past the barrage balloons that hovered in the sky like enormous dead and bloated fish. Emmy was letting go of so much, and yet her heart felt so heavy. Mum squeezed Emmy's arm when she did not answer. Promise me, Emmy. She's your daughter, Emmy whispered, and tears sprang to her eyes. She loved Julia, but she would not have agreed to leave London if she did not have to consider Julia. Mum should be evacuating with Julia, not her. And you're her sister. The man called again for their bus. The little tag around Emmy's neck fluttered in between her and Mum, lifting off her chest for a second as a breeze ruffled it. Emmy looked into Mum's tawny brown eyes. You ruin everything. The words fell off her tongue as easy as a song. But the minute she said them, she wanted to pull the words back and shove them to the dark place where they'd been hiding since Mum got the evacuation notice. Mum arched one eyebrow, just the one, and only slightly so. I didn't ask for any of this. She let go of Emmy's arm. None of it. Be careful what you hate, Em. Mum now bent forward toward Julia, whose face was awash in uncertainty. You stay with Emmy now, and don't give her trouble, pet, all right? Mum drew Julia into her arms. When she let go of her younger daughter and stood, Mum's eyes were glistening. Mind the people who will be looking after you. I'll come and visit you as soon as I can. I'll write you. And you can write me. Julia nodded, pleased, it seemed, to think of writing Mum a letter, something she had never done, and getting letters from someone in the post, also a new and exciting concept. But then in an instant her eyes widened in alarm. Wait, what about Neville? What if he comes back? He won't know where I am. Yes, Mum, what about Neville? Emmy echoed, with none of Julia's distress, but plenty of cheek. Just how long was she supposed to pretend Julia's father wasn't dead? Mum ignored Emmy. I'll take care of that, pet. So you'll tell him? Julia asked, less alarmed but still worried, and perhaps a little upset with herself for not having thought of this before. Yes, I'll take care of everything. Mum answered Julia's question without answering it at all, and then turned to Emmy. She did not hold out her arms to embrace her. Instead, she cupped one hand under Emmy's chin. Don't forget what I said, Emmy. Emmy didn't have to be told to watch out for her little sister. She was more of a mother to Julia than their mum was. She always had been, even those rare times when she resented the responsibility. Do you really think I would let anything happen to her? Emmy said, pulling her chin out of her mother's slight grasp. Mum let her arm drop. I'm talking about what I said about what you choose to hate. You don't know everything. I know you think you do, but you don't. And you think you know everything. You don't know what Mrs. Crofton said about my drawings because you don't want to know. You haven't even asked. They mean nothing to you. Well, they're everything to me, Mum, just so you know. Mum shook her head. For the love of God, Emmeline. You're so young. Just because I'm young doesn't mean I can't make my own decisions about my future. You of all people should know that. An official walking by saw Emmy's and Julia's name tags and where they were bound. Come along then, lasses. Right here now. You'll see your mum soon enough. Off you go then. With the official's hand gently on her back, Emmy reached for the book of fairy tales that Julia had in one hand, and then looped the handle of her gas mask box over her wrist. Emmy added the book to what she already carried in the crook of her arm. Carry your suitcase in one hand, and grab hold of my skirt with the other. Don't let go. Emmy told her. They walked away from Mum, carrying luggage that had appeared in the flat the previous day, out of nowhere, and which smelled slightly of men's aftershave. In her other arm, Emmy carried Julia's book, the bride's box, and a sack lunch that Mum said Mrs. Billingsley had bought for her and Julia from her favorite sandwich shop. Julia turned back to wave to Mum as she stepped up to board the bus, a red double-decker that had been pulled from its usual task of ferrying tourists around London. Emmy turned as well. Mum stood unmoving, her arms folded across her chest, as people scurried about, her expression unreadable. She unhooked one arm to return Julia's wave, and to blow her a kiss. When her eyes met Emmy's, she lifted her chin slightly, as if to communicate she was pleased that Emmy had realized they weren't so very different from each other after all. Chapter 9. Emmy had traveled on a train outside the heart of London only once before. During one of Neville's stretches of living with Mum, he took them all to Brighton Beach for a weekend at the sea. He wanted to take only Mum. Emmy remembered that had been obvious. But they hadn't lived in Whitechapel then, so they hadn't had Thea for a neighbor. There was no one who could take the sisters for the weekend. Mum didn't like any of their neighbors at the time, and they didn't like her, according to Mum. Emmy believed that what they didn't like was Neville floating in and out of the flat, sometimes with an actor friend or two, and that they often loudly rehearsed lines at 3 o'clock in the morning from the bawdy shows they were in. The only other friends Mum had were fellow laundry maids at the hotel where she was working, but none of them had wanted to babysit a 3- and an 11-year-old for an entire weekend. Emmy had liked the train ride. She loved the sea. The rest of the weekend was forgettable. As she and Julia now sat side by side on the train, she wanted to stay angry at Mum, at the Germans, at the British War Office, at God Almighty himself for whisking her out of London, when she was on the very edge of having everything. But as the city sights fell away, and the landscape relaxed to rolling hills and fields of yellow, she found herself unable to stay angry. The rumbling of the train, the scenery outside her window, and even the lunch Julia and she shared, the nicest they had ever had, calmed Emmy to a state of ordinary melancholy. When they changed trains in Oxford for the last leg of the trip by rail, Emmy's anger had mellowed to something more like grief. There were 70 evacuees on the train to Morton and Marsh, accompanied not by one of the schoolteachers, as the larger groups had been, but by a uniformed matron who reminded Emmy somewhat of Nana. Her build was the same, as was her silver-brown hair. She allowed Emmy, the oldest in their group, to call her Alice instead of Mrs. Broughton. As they were about to pull into the station at Morton and Marsh, Alice asked if Emmy would keep an eye on the trio of young boys, all classmates of Julius, who were seated behind the girls and who had spent the 40-minute journey from Oxford laughing, poking one another, and kicking the back of the girls' seats.
"Just see that they don't get separated from the group," Alice said as the whistle blew,
and the train began to approach the station. "We're being met at the station, and from there we'll walk to the town hall. Just a short stroll. I'll bring up the rear. If you wouldn't mind staying in the middle, that would be grand." Emmy nodded in soundless compliance.
"There's a brave girl,"
Alice said, mistaking Emmy's quietness for timidity. She squeezed Emmy's shoulder before making her way back to the front of the train car. Once they were off the train, it took some doing to corral the boys and convince them to stay where Emmy could see them. Then the lot of children formed a queue, and a billeting official counted heads, comparing names with a list she had in her hand. Their suitcases had been loaded onto a truck, so that they would not need to carry them the 3 blocks to the hall, where they were to be sorted out. And then the young Londoners were off, like soldiers marching to the battlefield, or prisoners to their cells, Emmy thought.
"I have to go to the loo,"
Julia murmured, her hand tight in Emmy's.
"You just went at Oxford. That was a long time ago. Think about something else. As soon as we get to the next place, I'll find one for you." "I can't think of something else."
"Yes, you can."
The 3 boys ahead of them stopped to look at a dead bird on the sidewalk. "Come on, boys," Emmy said.
"I dare you to touch it, Julia,"
one of the boys said.
"I dare you to eat it,"
Julia challenged, her hand tighter now in her sister's. Emmy kicked the tiny carcass with her shoe. It landed in the gutter.
"You can compose dares later. Off you go."
They continued on their way, past shops and cafes and businesses. The town was like Brighton in some ways. The buildings were close to one another, and there were a few taxis and no red double-decker buses. But there was no fragrance of the sea, no one selling pasties or ice cream cones on the sidewalk. And in Brighton, no one seemed to even notice when they had arrived, or cared when they left. Here, everyone stopped whatever they were doing to look at the line of children. From the barber sweeping his front step, to the grocer standing by wooden crates full of turnips, to women in unremarkable dresses going about their afternoon errands. 2 young mothers pushing prams on the sidewalk moved aside so that the group could stay together. Emmy heard one whisper to the other.
"Oh, these are the London children. The poor dears."
And the other one replied,
"Can you imagine sending your child away like that? Or taking one in? Good heavens, you wouldn't know anything about them."
"Nor do we know anything about you," Emmy whispered as she and Julia walked by them. She heard nothing else from the 2 pram pushers, and did not look back at them. After another block, they were at the town hall on High Street. The curbs were crowded with parked cars on either side. A few adults, mostly women, were standing outside on the steps, watching as the children made their way past them.
"Welcome to Morton and Marsh,"
one of them said, but her tone suggested she was nervous about the children being there. The young evacuees were the evidence that everything was different now. The war was no longer phony, as some had called it. It was real. And here were London's children to prove it. They were ushered into a large reception room, filled with tables, folding chairs, and people talking in small groups. The luggage had arrived, and 2 men were now unloading it from a cart and lining the suitcases like dominoes against the back wall. At one table, officials sat with their papers and clipboards. At another were cups of water,
tea biscuits, and meringues. The boys in Emmy's care rushed to the food table, and she let them go. She had done what had been asked of her. She got them there without losing them. Emmy looked around for a sign indicating a privy, found one, and started to head in that direction, Julia's hand in hers.
"You need to stay with your group."
A woman wearing an armband said to her,
"My sister needs to use the loo,"
Emmy said and kept walking.
"What are those people doing back there?"
Julia asked as Emmy led her down a narrow hall to one of the two doors marked WC.
"They're here for all of us."
Emmy opened the door for her.
"But why are they looking at us like that?"
"They've never seen children from London before. So you and I are like two princesses to them. That's why." This satisfied her. She let go of Emmy's hand. When they returned to the big room, Julia said she was hungry. They made their way to the refreshments, and Emmy could not help but notice how the people in the room watched as she and Julia approached the table, studying how the girls respected their hospitality. For one crazed second, Emmy wanted to lean over and lick all the meringues.
"Just take one," she murmured to Julia, "until you know everyone's had something." "I know how to share, Emmy,"
Julia murmured back, her brow crinkled in annoyance. A woman stepped up to a microphone and tapped it. A loud clunking and a short squawk followed.
"All right, then," she said. "If all the children could stand behind me here, we can get started. If you were here to collect an evacuee or two, if you could please make your way to my left, so that we can keep everything in order."
"Splendid." Everyone did as they were told. As the crowd of adults moved to stand where they could face the children, Emmy noted that the expressions on the faces were no different from those she had seen hours ago in the schoolyard. These country people wore the same look of apprehension mixed with hope. They wanted to believe, just as the parents in the schoolyard did, that this was without a doubt the course of action to take. The evacuation was how their nation would do battle, and yet protect the blameless. Some would have to release a child into the care of a stranger, and some would have to take in the beloved child of someone they had never met. The war demanded that strangers could no longer exist in England. It wasn't until the villagers began to pick whom they would take home that Emmy saw how the two groups were different. The parents in the schoolyard had not been able to choose anything. Not which bus their child would board, not which town they would go to, not which family would take them in. These people, on the other hand, looked the evacuees over as though they were shopping for their Christmas goose. The foster parents, as the woman at the microphone called them, were invited to come speak with the children so that they could all get to know one another. As the people began to move toward them, Julia grabbed Emmy's hand. Her little sister's fingers were sticky from the meringue. A couple approached the girls. They were older than Mum, younger than Nana would have been. The woman smelled like furniture polish, and the man had a giant mole on his cheek that looked like it was made of roast beef. They told the girls their names, Mr. and Mrs. Trimble, and said how nice it was to meet them. Then they asked the sisters for their names.
"I'm Emmeline Downtree, and this is my sister Julia,"
Emmy said. Julia, wide-eyed, said nothing. The woman bent down and touched Julia's corn silk hair.
"My, aren't you a pretty little cherub?"
Julia looked at Emmy. She could see her question in the little girl's eyes.
"What's a cherub?"
"Say thank you,"
Emmy whispered. Julia obeyed. The woman peered at Julia's tag, and then crinkled her brow in pity.
"Oh, so you've only a mum, then. What happened to your dad, little one?"
"He's in India,"
Julia said.
"He's making a movie about the treasure of the seven lost princes."
"What's that?" said the man. Julia proudly repeated the answer to the question. Mr. and Mrs. Trimble swiveled their surprised faces to look at Emmy.
"What is it exactly that your father is doing in India?"
the woman said to her. After a morning of not knowing what anything was about, to be asked something about which she had ample knowledge loosened Julia's tongue.
Neville's not her dad,
Julia said without a hint of embarrassment.
He's only mine, but I just call him Neville. We don't know where Emmy's father is.
The couple stared at Emmy, thoroughly scandalized. Emmy didn't care. Maybe if no one wanted her, she and Julia would be put back on a train to London. Several long seconds passed before Mr. and Mrs. Trimble recovered.
"Aren't you a little old to be sent off to the countryside?"
Mr. Trimble finally said to Emmy. Emmy laughed. She couldn't help it. For the last 5 days, she had tried to convince everyone of this exact thing, and no one would listen to her. Now here she was, in a strange little village, standing in front of a couple obviously appalled by the details of her existence. And the man had pronounced, with no urging from Emmy, what she had so desperately wanted everyone else to say.
"Oh, my,"
the woman murmured. Emmy's ill-timed chuckle only added to Mrs. Trimble's growing impression of Emmy as an undesirable foster child.
"I couldn't agree with you more," Emmy said,
reining in her amusement.
"Believe me, I'd much rather be home than standing here talking to you."
Seconds of silence.
"Well, we'll just take little Julia here then, can't we, Howard?"
"No," Emmy said before Mr. Trimble could respond.
"I beg your pardon?"
the woman said.
"I said no."
Alice, hovering nearby, sidled up to the girls, her expression anxious.
"We try to keep the siblings together if we can,"
she said, looking from Emmy to the couple.
"We can only take the little one," the man said.
"Then you'll need to keep shopping," Emmy said.
"Julia stays with me."
Alice admonished Emmy with her eyes. She could read what the woman was communicating to her. It was something along the lines of, "Can you please try to be nice?"
"Come along, Margaret."
The man put his hand on his wife's back to guide her away from the sisters.
"But Howard, I want the little one,"
the woman protested. Howard Trimble ignored his wife, but turned his gaze on Emmy.
"A word of advice," he said with feigned courtesy. "You'll get nowhere with that attitude. You should be thinking about your little sister."
"That's exactly what I'm doing," Emmy replied, matching his tone.
"She stays with me."
Their conversation had attracted some attention. As Howard and Margaret Trimble moved away, Emmy noticed other conversations had stilled. People were staring at her. Alice leaned in close.
"I can see that you're not happy about being here, Emmeline, but please try to be polite, or I'm afraid no one will want to take you."
"I don't care if no one wants to take me.
And who are these people to look down on all of us and decide which of us they want? We should be choosing them."
Alice shushed her.
"Keep your voice down."
All eyes were on Emmy now. She and Julia would be back on the train in no time. She was sure of it.
"I will not keep my voice down. I will not allow my sister and me to be trafficked like slaves. This is debasing."
No, I'm sure these are good people. And all of us forced out of our homes, are we not good people? Do we really deserve to be picked over and poked like melons on market day?"
There wasn't a sound now in the room, except Emmy's voice. Howard Trimble, a few feet away, was shaking his head. It was no surprise to him that Emmy was mouthing off like she was. What could one expect from someone like her, an illegitimate urchin of a girl? For a long moment, there were only silence and wide-eyed stares. Then Emmy saw a movement out of the corner of her eye. And then there was a voice.
"You are absolutely right, my dear."
Emmy turned. The woman who had spoken was older than either of the Trimbles. Her silver hair, flecked with hints of a former coffee brown, was bound in a braid that lay across her shoulder, and then trailed down past her left breast. She was tall and slender, and her skin was wrinkled, but in a nice way. As if she had one day started smiling, and then had never stopped. She was wearing a cornflower blue blouse and twill skirt, with a smudge in the hem that suggested she had been gardening that day. The spectacles on her face were slightly skewed. Perhaps she had recently sat on them, and had to bend them back into shape.
"Please forgive our thoughtlessness," the woman said.
Emmy didn't detect a hint of sarcasm or a patronizing tone, but she said nothing.
"Please,"
she continued.
"My name is Charlotte Havelock. It would be my great honor to welcome you and your sister Julia at Thistle House during this distressing time of war. I have a nice bedroom for you to sleep in, and a garden to play and read in. And I promise to treat you with all the respect that you are due. That is, if you will have me."
Again silence reigned in the room. Emmy felt Julia tugging on her shirt. She looked down at her little sister.
"I like her,"
she whispered. The woman smiled. The room was library quiet, and Emmy still had everyone's attention. Alice nodded to Emmy, a wordless gesture of desperation. She wanted Emmy to be wanted by someone. It made her job easier. There was no going back to London. Emmy could see that in her eyes, too. She would have to find a place for the girls, if not here in Morton and Marsh, then in some other little town. Emmy could not return to London by refusing Charlotte Havelock's invitation. But she would return to London. One way or another she would return. It was just a matter of time.
"All right," Emmy said.
Charlotte Havelock extended her hand, and Emmy, after a second's hesitation, took it. Charlotte's grip was warm and firm.
"Shall we take care of the paperwork, then?"
She released Emmy's hand, and an open-mouthed Alice led them all to the billeting table to complete the process. Several seconds passed before the hum of conversation resumed. Charlotte filled out her contact information, so that Mum could be notified where Emmy and Julia would be staying. Emmy looked over her shoulder as Charlotte wrote. Her home, Thistle House, was located in Stow-in-the-Wold, a village Emmy had never heard of. Charlotte set the pen down and turned to the sisters.
"Let's go home."
Chapter 10. The road between Morton and Marsh and Stow-on-the-Wold was narrow but straight, taking them past rock walls, grazing sheep, fields of hay, and cottages of fawn-colored stone. London and all that Emmy had left behind seemed remarkably distant. It was as if they were traveling back in time, or maybe to an entirely different world. There were no sandbags here, no air raid shelter signs, no barrage balloons in this endless sky. Emmy wondered how anyone out in this vast countryside knew they were even at war. She and Julia sat up front with Charlotte in a dusty blue jalopy that sputtered like a steam engine as she drove. It was a 4.5-mile jaunt between the two towns, Charlotte said. But since she lived on the edge of Stow, it would seem more like 5. The woman filled the silence inside the car by telling the girls about herself, which allowed Emmy to sit back and memorize the route they were taking so that one day soon, if she had to, she could make her way back to London on her own. Charlotte was 66, a retired schoolteacher, and a widow of 5 years. She and her husband, Oliver, hadn't been blessed with any children. But she had a younger sister, Rose, whose disabilities made her childlike in many ways, so Charlotte felt as though she'd been gifted the chance to mother someone. Oliver, bless his soul, had owned a hardware store in Stow-on-the-Wold, as had his father before him, and his father before him. He had been quite handy and liked to build things. She had an indoor loo before anyone else she knew did, thanks to Oliver. The century-old house had been in Oliver's family all that time, and had a lovely name, Thistle House. Many houses in the Cotswolds had names.
"What is a Cotswold?"
Julia asked. Charlotte Havelock smiled.
The Cotswolds is everything you can see out the window. For lots of miles. 100 of them. Think of England as a very large book. The Cotswolds would be an unfussy chapter in the middle somewhere, where there is lots of limestone and even more sheep.
But what is a Cotswold? I want to see one.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean. I'd like to see one too. Here's the thing. Everyone agrees wold means hills, but not everyone agrees what the Cots are.
That's easy, Julia said. Cots are little beds.
Indeed. Charlotte's smile was broad. Right you are, Julia. Charlotte then told the girls that she had been born in Cornwall, near the coast, and that she met Oliver at his brother's wedding in Bristol in 1893. They fell in love and married a year later, and she moved to Thistle House. It had been her home ever since. She and her husband took in Rose 18 years ago, when Charlotte and Rose's mother died. I know I wasn't born here in the Cotswolds, but I feel like I was. This place has a way of welcoming you in, even if you are a stranger. Her words were meant to convey welcome, but Emmy didn't want to imagine she could belong there, even for a little while. Still, she sensed the subtle embrace of Charlotte's seemingly warless world, where everything appeared to be bathed in butter. I've never seen so many houses and buildings all made of the same yellow stone, Emmy said. That's Cotswold stone. We are sitting on a vast blanket of limestone here. Loads of it. They've been building with it for centuries. When it's been out in the weather, decade upon decade, it turns a lovely honey color, which is rather nice. Can you imagine if it turned pink with age?
I like pink, Julia chimed.
A lovely color for flowers, but not so much for houses, Charlotte said. It's pretty here, Emmy said, unable to stay disconnected from her new surroundings. The woman nodded. I think so too, Emmeline. I know it's not your home, and I wish there weren't a war, but I do want you to feel it is your home, for as long as it must be such for you. Her words were heavy with the weight of what could happen. No one knew how long the war would last, or how long England could defend herself. But Emmy refused to give in to such negative thinking on the first day of the evacuation. I'm sure it won't be for very long, she said. I hope you're right. I really do. The three of them were silent for a few seconds. When Charlotte spoke again, her voice was bright.
Now then, would you girls like to call me Mrs. Havelock, or Aunt Charlotte?
I like Aunt Charlotte,
Julia answered. This woman, kind though she was not Emmy's aunt.
I prefer Mrs. Havelock, she said.
Charlotte regarded Emmy for a moment, taking her eyes off the road ahead for a second or two. You know, Emmeline, you're very nearly an adult. How about you call me Charlotte? Fine with me. Right then. That's settled. So here's Stowe. They entered a village that was what Morton might have been like 50 years before. Stores and offices made of Cotswold stone lined both sides of the street that led into the center of town, some with thatched roofs, some with shingles. They passed a town hall, a pub, a grocer, a bank, a butcher, a dentist. There seemed to be one of everything needed for a town to survive on its own, without any interaction from the outside ever.
There's the hardware store,
Charlotte said, pointing to a toast-brown building, with a shiny red sign with black lettering in front.
It's called Brown and Sons Hardware now.
Used to be Havelock Hardware. We sold it the year Ollie retired. I used to have tea with him Saturday afternoons before Rose came. I'd bring it down in the basket of my bike. Down that way is our train station, so if your mum wants to come see you, she can come straight here. Oh, and there's my church. Charlotte nodded toward a castle-like structure, with a bright blue door
and a steeple arrowing past the treetops. And down that way is the primary school. The secondary school is back behind us a bit. I'll show them to you sometime if you want.
That's all right,
Emmy said as politely as she could. She didn't see much purpose to that. It was June. The school term was 3 months away. Then they were back in the countryside, on a narrow, tree-lined lane.
This is the Morgesbury Road,
Charlotte said.
The village officials had to take all the road signs down because of the war, but everyone here knows this road leads to Little Morgesbury.
Rose and I live in the edge of both towns. Morgesbury is small, just a few houses, some farms, and the manor, really.
Now, tell me about you. What do you girls like to do when you're not in school?
Emmy nodded to Julia, so that she could answer first.
Well, I like going to the park and playing with my paper dolls, and I like Thea's cat and kittens, and I like going to my friend Sybil's house because she has lots of toys. And her own tea set.
Well, how lovely.
Charlotte beamed. My back garden is sort of like a park. I've lots of fruit trees, and a little pond, and a vegetable garden, and chickens. And I have the tea set that was mine when I was a little girl. I'll have to get it out for you.
Do you have a pony?
Julia said, as animated as Emmy had seen her since Thea's kittens were born.
I don't have a pony, but my neighbour has two goats, Edgar and Clementine, and my other neighbour has a miniature horse named Jingles.
Julia whipped her head around to face Emmy, her eyes bright with anticipation, and an I-told-you-so gleam.
How about you, Emmeline? What do you like to do?
Emmy draws brides,
Julia said before Emmy could answer, her attention fully back on Charlotte.
She draws brides?
Their dresses. She has drawn a whole bunch. She gave me some. I have them inside my book. You want to see?
Well, perhaps when I'm not driving.
Charlotte glanced at Emmy, hoping for a fuller explanation.
I like to sketch bridal designs, Emmy said. I am planning to become a designer. I had a job at a bridal shop until today.
Oh, I see. I'm so sorry you had to leave it, Emmeline. Her empathy was genuine and full, almost too much for Emmy to handle.
Her dresses are really pretty,
Julia continued, and Emmy was happy for the interruption.
She has them in the bride's box. I like to look at them, and Emmy lets me whenever I want, as long as she is there with me. I'm not supposed to get them out when she's not home.
I would love to see them sometime,
Charlotte said.
If you don't mind showing them to me, that is.
Sure, Emmy said. Charlotte's interest, almost maternal in nature, was strangely welcome.
If you like, I can show you my wedding dress sometime,
Charlotte said, her smile broad.
Oh my goodness, Emmeline, just wait until you see what was in style back when I got married. Would you like to?
Emmy nodded, and a smile tugged at the corners of her mouth. She found she could not speak. Charlotte seemed to pick up on this. It was as if she knew Emmy needed the topic of discussion, to shift to something not so desperately personal.
So we are almost at Thistle House,
Charlotte said.
I need to tell you girls that my sister Rose is a dear soul, but she's a bit forgetful and simple-minded. She's only a year younger than I am, but he would do me a great favor by thinking of her, if you don't mind, as if she were 5.
Why does she think she's 5?
Julia asked, genuinely concerned.
She doesn't think she's 5. She just has a difficult time thinking like an adult would think. Rose was in an accident a long time ago. It was very bad, and we thought she might die.
She finally came back to us, but she came back different. When she woke up from her injuries, it was as if she were a little girl again, and she just stayed that way How old was she when that happened? Emmy's sympathies had been aroused, as only a fellow sister's would. She was 13, a very long time ago. I'm sorry. Emmy didn't know what else to say. It's all right. My parents and I just learned to love the new Rose. It actually wasn't that hard to do. Charlotte laughed nervously, as though the accident was still fresh in her mind. Once we let go of the old Rose. Here we are. They turned down a narrow gravel path, wide enough for only one car, which, after a slight curve, led to a house constructed of Cotswold stone, with wood trim painted forest green. Climbing roses rioted across the front gate, and ivy crawled up the side walls. Gabled windows on the second story boasted window boxes of white and pink geraniums. A brass oval nailed to the stone framing the doorway read Thistle House. It was such a charming storybook place that Emmy instinctively reached into her skirt pocket to touch the ticket stub from Paddington Station and the key to Primrose nestled behind it. She needed to remind herself that she really had awakened that morning in London. Julia was similarly awestruck. There was no house like this in their little corner of the world. And that corner was all her sister knew. Julia held her fairy tale book close to her chest, her eyes wide with wonder and doubt. They got out of the car. Charlotte, carrying Julia's suitcase, walked up the stone pathway to the front door and opened it wide. "Welcome to Thistle House, Emmeline and Julia. My home is yours." The short, narrow entryway led to a sitting room and a staircase straight ahead, a kitchen and pantry and a privy on the left, and a dining room and living area on the right. In Charlotte's absence, Rose had been looked after by a neighbor who lived nearby. Mrs. Tinley bid them all welcome and then left by the garden door to return to her home. Rose looked a lot like Charlotte. She had the same nose and chin, the same eyes, even the same long silvery braid. Their voices had the same tone and timbre. Their sameness seemed to accentuate Julia's and Emmy's differences. Julia's fair skin, green eyes, and blonde hair were all Neville. Emmy's brown hair was darker than Mum's, and so were her eyes. Charlotte led the girls to the table, where Rose sat surrounded by a pile of magazines. "Rose, these are the children from London I was telling you about. This is Emmeline, and this is Julia." Rose languidly blinked at the girls. "Are they staying in my room?" she finally said, frowning. "No, they're in the guest room, remember?" Rose studied the sisters for another long moment. "The green towels are mine, but I'll share them." Then she bent over her magazine. "How about I show you to your room, and then we'll have a nice tea out in the garden." They made their way back to the main entry, and to the staircase that led to the three bedrooms upstairs. The guest room was decorated in shades of yellow, with dormer windows graced with eyelet valances and the familiar blackout curtains. So they did know about the war here, Emmy thought. Two four-poster beds were side by side, both covered with daisy-patterned quilts and ruffled bedskirts. Each one was paired with a bedside table. Directly across from the beds, and on the other side of the door, was a tall wardrobe, painted white and decorated with sunflowers. A tall bureau painted white with yellow glass knobs filled one slanted wall, and a desk with a little gooseneck table lamp sat along another. A waist-high lace-covered table stood next to the desk. It was the prettiest bedroom Emmy had ever seen. "I've emptied all but the bottom bureau drawer for you," Charlotte said, "and more than half the wardrobe, and I've put some writing paper in the desk for you, so you can write home to your mum or your friends as often as you wish. I wrote down my address on a little card there so that you can let people know where you are." "Thank you," Emmy murmured, the most she could say at that moment. A long pause followed, as Emmy and Julia stared at the room that was to be theirs.
Would you like to settle in and unpack first?
Or would you like to do that later, and come outside to the garden for a little tea? Charlotte said. Julia finally found her voice.
May we see the chickens?
Charlotte laughed. Of course. Right this way. She turned to leave, and Julia was right on her heels, grabbing Charlotte's hand as she stepped out of the room. Watching Julia so easily reach for Charlotte's hand took Emmy aback for only a moment. Half a moment, really. That was how long it took her to realize the situation was perfect. For Julia. She would write a letter that very night and give Mrs. Crofton her new address. When the day came that Mrs. Crofton informed Emmy that Mr. Dabney had returned to London, she could sneak away and leave Julia here with no reservations whatsoever. Julia would be happy here. And Emmy would be happy to be returning to London and getting on with her life. Everyone would be happy. Emmy followed her sister. Chapter 11. With teacups in hand, Charlotte and Emmy settled onto padded metal chairs, in the shade of a towering poplar tree, while Julia scampered about the garden. Rose trailed after Julia, with casual but undeniable interest. Paved in Cotswold stone, the little terrace where they sat sipping tea was surrounded on three sides by more trees, flower beds, a sizable vegetable garden, orchard trees, a chicken coop, and, beyond the perimeter of Charlotte's property, a murky pond that ended in reeds and a horizon of blue pearl sky. "I don't need to worry about Julia getting too close to the pond, do I?" Emmy said as Julia skipped after a pair of wood ducks, waddling toward the water.
"It's quite shallow at the edge, unless you think she will run headlong into it," Charlotte replied. "I'm sure she will be fine, and Rose will get after her if she goes too close."
"She will."
"Well, not necessarily because she senses danger. She just knows how I feel about muddy shoes in the house."
Emmy took a sip of her tea and sat back in her chair.
"You felt responsible for your sister for a long time, haven't you?"
Charlotte said. But her gaze was on Julia, 100 yards away. For a second, Emmy wasn't sure how to respond. She sensed admiration in Charlotte's tone. Or maybe solidarity, as she had obviously taken on responsibility for her own sister, Rose, albeit to a much greater extent.
"I suppose I have. It's not like I had a choice. Our mum's not... she's not like most mothers. She's..."
Emmy's voice fell away. She didn't know what word she was looking for.
"She's ill."
Emmy shook her head, and a tiny laugh escaped her.
"No, she's not ill. She's... she was only 16 when she had me. She's never been married, and Julie and I don't even have the same father. Her mother, my Nana, was hard on her. They didn't get on very well. I think maybe Mum's getting pregnant, both times, was something my Nana never forgave her for."
"And yet it takes two people to create a baby," Charlotte said gently,
pouring more tea into her cup, from the teapot sitting on a little table between them. She offered the pot to Emmy, who silently extended her cup. Charlotte's soft but candid tone surprised Emmy. Mum had spoken to her from time to time about men, mostly how Emmy should not trust the ones who liked to say nice things about how she looked. Mum never talked about sex with Emmy. Everything Emmy knew about how babies were made, she had learned from classmates at school, in hushed conversations peppered with twittering laughter.
"Did neither father provide for your mother?"
Charlotte continued when Emmy said nothing.
Well, Neville, that's Julia's father. He liked being a father when it was convenient for him, and when it didn't get in the way of things he liked better. And he didn't know how to handle money, if that's what you mean. Whenever he had any, he spent it as soon as he got it. He was an actor, and was unemployed a lot of the time.
Was?
Emmy looked to Julia running up and down the back of the pond.
He died in a car accident in Dublin not too long ago.
Oh, I'm very sorry.
Emmy brought her attention back to Charlotte. Julia doesn't know he's dead. She thinks he's still in India. Mom has always made up stories about where Neville was when he would disappear, so that's where she thinks he is. It's been a year since she's seen him. Charlotte nodded thoughtfully.
I see.
And Julia doesn't ask about him.
Sometimes. She can go for weeks without mentioning him, and then she'll see something that reminds her of him, and she'll ask when he's coming back.
Strange she calls him by his first name, isn't it?
Emmy shrugged.
It suited him. And Julia didn't care. She liked him because he'd bring her trinkets and toys now and then, and he never did any of the things that little children wish their parents wouldn't do, like make them mind, or insist they eat their vegetables, or demand they clean their room.
So you don't think she should be told he has died?
It's Mum who thinks she shouldn't be told. She found out he was dead the same day the evacuation notice came. Mum said it was too much for Julia to handle all at once. She made me promise I wouldn't say anything, so I haven't.
Off in the distance, Rose knelt down and Julia followed suit. Rose was showing Julia something in the water.
One of the turtles, probably, Charlotte said, as if reading Emmy's mind. We've several that prefer our edge of the pond.
Emmy watched as Julia put her hand in the water, squealed with delight, and drew it back out.
And what about your father, then, if I may ask?
Charlotte said. Emmy hesitated a moment before answering.
You can ask, but I haven't much to say about him. I don't know who he is.
Mum said he was not someone I ever needed to think about.
Charlotte furrowed her brow.
So she was not in love with him.
Again, Emmy shrugged.
I guess not. I don't know. She met him at a party, apparently. And she had been drinking.
At such a young age?
It happens.
And no one held the young man responsible. Emmy had always pictured Mum having met someone a bit older than she was at the party, who had changed the course of her life, not another teenager like herself. It wasn't until Emmy was sitting there with Charlotte, discussing the very thing Mum and Nana never talked about, that she suddenly realized that if her father was a few years older than Mum, then he'd taken advantage of an underage girl, and that was against the law. He would have been arrested if Mum had named him. That Emmy had never given this any thought irritated her. She looked up at Charlotte, and her face must have revealed that she had realized something she hadn't considered.
What is it, dear?
Charlotte said.
Nothing.
Emmy drained her cup.
It all made sense.
No one had held her father responsible, because Mum hadn't identified him. That was why there was such animosity between Mum and Nana. Any parent whose barely 16-year-old daughter ended up pregnant would want to know who the father was. If Mum had refused to say, which surely was the case, it could only have been for one of three reasons that Emmy could think of. She had been protecting the man. She was embarrassed to admit she didn't know his name. Or she had struck a deal with him. Emmy set her cup down on the little table, angry that she had let herself be satisfied for 15 years with such vague answers about who her father was.
Emmeline?
Can we talk about something else?
A slight pause.
Of course.
At that moment, Julia called for Emmy to come look at the baby turtles. She and Charlotte rose from their chairs, and Emmy was thankful that the conversation she had wanted to end fell away, but only partially so. She knew she would revisit it in her strange bed that night. A few seconds later, they were all at the water's edge, and Julia was pointing to several young turtles swimming in the shallows, their little armored backs glistening. A few feet away, the wood ducks that Julia had followed paddled toward the pond's center. A pair of dragonflies darted past them and skimmed across the water's surface. Surrounded by such pastoral splendor, Emmy found it hard.